Disc 7.
Mrs. Quinn, I said when a woman answered. Yes? This is Dr. K. Scarpetta. I have the results from Sonny's... Haven't you heard us enough? I thought you might like to know why your son died. I don't need you to tell me anything about my son, she snapped. I could hear someone taking the phone from her as my heart hammered. This is Mr. Quinn, said the man whose shield was religious freedom and whose son, as a result, was dead. Sonny's cause of death was acute pneumonia due to acute diabetic ketoacidosis due to acute onset of diabetes mellitus. I'm sorry for your pain, Mr. Quinn. This is all a mistake. An error. There's no mistake, Mr. Quinn. No error, I said, and it was all I could do to keep the anger out of my voice. I can only suggest that if your other young children show Sonny's same symptoms, that you get them medical treatment immediately, so you don't have to suffer this way again. I don't need some medical examiner telling me how to raise my children, he coldly said. Lady, I'll see you in court. That you will, I thought, for I knew the Commonwealth would charge him and his wife with felony child abuse and neglect. Don't you call us any more, said Mr. Quinn, and he hung up on me. I returned the receiver to its cradle with a heavy heart and looked up to see T.N. McGovern standing in the hallway just outside my door. I could tell by the look on her face that she had heard every word. T.N., come in, I said. And I thought my job was hard. Her eyes were on mine as she took a chair and moved it directly across from me. I know you have to do this all the time, but I guess I never really heard it. It's not that I don't talk to families all the time, but thankfully it's not my job to tell them exactly what inhaling smoke did to their loved one's trachea or lungs. It's the hardest part, I said simply, and the weight inside me would not go away. I guess you're the messenger they want to kill. Not always, I said, and I knew that in the solitude of my raw inner self, I would hear the Quinn's accusing harsh words replay for the rest of my days. There were so many voices now, screams and prayers of rage and pain and sometimes blame, because I had dared to touch the wounds and because I would listen. I did not want to talk about this with McGovern. I did not want her to get any closer to me. I've got one more phone call to make, I said. So if you want to get coffee or just relax for a minute, I'm sure you'll be interested in what I find out. I called the University of North Carolina at Wilmington, and although it was not quite 9, the registrar was in. He was excruciatingly polite, but not at all helpful. I completely understand why you're calling and promise that we very much want to help, he was saying, but not without a court order. We can't simply decide to release personal information about any of our students, certainly not over the phone. Mr. Shedd, we're talking about a homicide, I reminded him, as impatience tugged at me again. I understand, he said again. This went on and got me nowhere. Finally, I gave up and got off the line. I was dejected when I returned my attention to McGovern. They're just covering their asses in case the family tries to come after them later, McGovern told me what I already knew. They need us to give them no choice, so I guess that's what we'll do. Right, I dully said. So what brings you here? I asked. I understand the lab results are in, or at least some of them. I called late Friday, she said. News to me? I was irked. If the trace evidence examiner had called McGovern before me, I was going to be really hot. I picked up the phone and called Mary Chan, a young examiner who was new with the labs. Good morning, I said. I understand you have some reports for me? I was just getting ready to bring them downstairs. These are the ones you've sent to ATF? Yes, the same ones. I can fax them or bring them in person. I gave her the number of the fax machine in my office, and I did not let her know my irritation, but I did give her a hint. Mary, in the future, it's best if you let me know about my cases before you start sending lab results to others, I calmly said. I'm sorry, and I could tell she very much was. The investigator called at 5 as I was halfway out the door. The reports were in my hands 2 minutes later, and McGovern opened her battered briefcase to retrieve her copies. She watched me as I read. The first was an analysis of the metal-like shaving that I had recovered from the dead woman's cut to the left temporal region. According to the scanning electron microscope and energy dispersive X-ray, or SEM-EDX, the elemental composition of the material in question was magnesium. As for the melted debris recovered from the victim's hair, those results were just as inexplicable. An FTIR, or Fourier Transform Infrared Spectrophotometer, had caused the fibers to selectively absorb infrared light. The characteristic pattern turned out to be that of the chemical polymer polysiloxane, or silicone. "A little strange, don't you think?" McGovern asked me. "Let's start with magnesium," I said. "What comes to mind is seawater. There's plenty of magnesium in that. Or mining. Or the person was an industrial chemist, or worked in a research lab. What about explosives?" "If potassium chloride came up, then yes. That could be flash powder," she answered. "Or RDX, lead stiffnate, lead azide of mercury fulminate, if we're talking about blasting caps, for example. Or nitric acid, sulfuric acid, glycerin, ammonium nitrate, sodium nitrate, nitroglycerin, dynamite, and so on and so on. And I will add that Pepper would have picked up on high explosives like that." "And magnesium?" I asked. "Pyrotechnics or fireworks," she said. "To produce the brilliant white light. Or flares," she shrugged. "Although aluminum powder is preferred because it keeps better unless the magnesium particles are coated with something like linseed oil." "Flares," I thought out loud. "You light flares, strategically place them and leave? That could buy you several minutes at least. With the appropriate fuel load, it could. But that doesn't explain an unburned turning or shaving of it embedded in her wound that would appear to have been transferred by the sharp instrument she was cut with." "They don't use magnesium to make knives," McGovern observed. "No, nothing like that. It's too soft. What about the aerospace industry, because it's so light?" "Most definitely. But in those instances, there are alloys that would have come up during testing." "Right. Let's move on to silicone, which doesn't seem to make any sense. Unless she had silicone breast implants before they were banned, which she clearly didn't." "I can tell you that silicone rubber is used in electrical insulation, hydraulic fluids, and for water repellency. None of which makes sense unless there was something in the bathroom. Maybe in the tub. Something pink, I don't know what." "Do we know if Sparks had a bath mat? Anything rubbery and pink in that bathroom?" I asked. "We've only begun going through his house with him," she said. "But he claims that the decor of the master bath was mostly black and white. The marble floor and walls were black. The sink, cabinets, and tub white. The shower door was European and wasn't tempered glass, meaning it didn't disintegrate into a billion little glass balls when the temperature exceeded 400 degrees Fahrenheit. Explaining why it basically melted over the body," I said. "Yeah, almost shrink-wrapped it." "Not quite," I said. "The door had brass hinges and no frame. What we recovered was consistent with that. So your friendly media tycoon's memory holds true at least on that score." "And on others?" "God only knows, Kay." She unbuttoned her suit jacket as if it suddenly occurred to her to relax while she paradoxically glanced up at the clock. "We're dealing with a very smart man," she said. "That much all of us know." "And the helicopter? What do you make of that, Tien? I'm assuming you've gotten word about the little white Schweitzer or Robinson or whatever it was that the farrier saw the day before the fire. Perhaps the same one you and I saw 2 days later?" "This is just a theory," she said. "A groping one at that, okay?" Her look was penetrating. "Maybe he sets the fire and needs to get to the airport fast," she went on. "So the day before, the helicopter does a recon over the farm because the pilot knows he'll have to land and take off after dark. Following so far?" I nodded. "Friday rolls around. Sparks murders the girl and torches his place. He runs out to the pasture and gets on the helicopter, which transports him somewhere near Dulles, where his Cherokee is stashed. He gets to the airport and does his thing with receipts and maybe baggage. Then he makes himself scarce until it's time to show up at Hoot Owl Farm." "And the reason the helicopter showed up on Saturday when we were working the scene?" I then asked. "How does that fit?"
"Pyros like to watch the fun," she stated. "Hell, for all we know, the guy was up there himself watching us work our asses off. Paranoid, if nothing else. Figured we'd think it was a news bird, which we did.
This is all speculation at this point, I said, and I had heard enough. I began rearranging the infinite flow of paperwork that began where it stopped and stopped where it began. McGovern was studying me again. She got up and shut the doors.
Okay, I think it's time we had a little talk, she said. I don't think you like me. And maybe if you come clean about it, maybe we can do something about it, one way or another.
I'm not sure what I think of you, if you must know. I stared at her. The most important thing is that all of us do our jobs, lest we lose perspective, since we are dealing with someone who was murdered, I added.
Now you're pissing me off, she said.
Not intentionally, I assure you.
As if someone murdered makes no difference to me? Is that what you're implying? You think I got where I was in life by not giving a shit about who set a fire and why?
She shoved up her sleeves, as if ready for a fight.
Tian, I said, I don't have time for this because I don't think it's constructive. This is about Lucy. You think I'm replacing you, or God knows what. That's what this is all about, isn't it, Kay? Now she was making me angry, too. You and I have worked together before, right? She went on. We've never had a big problem before now. So one has to ask, what's different? I think the answer's pretty obvious. The difference is that even as we speak, your niece is moving into her new apartment in Philadelphia to be in my field office under my supervision. Mine, not yours. And you don't like it. And guess what else? If I were in your shoes, maybe I wouldn't like it either.
It is neither the time nor the place for this discussion, I firmly said.
Fine. She got up and draped her jacket over her arm. Then we'll go somewhere else, she decided. I intend to resolve this before I drive back north. For an instant, I was stymied as I reined from the empire of my wraparound desk with its foreman of files and guards demanding the hard labor of journal articles and legions of messages and correspondence that would never set me free. I took my glasses off and massaged my face. When McGovern was blurred, it was easier for me.
I'll take you to lunch, I said, if you're willing to hang around 3 more hours.
In the meantime, I got up from my chair. I have bones in a pot that need heating up. You can come with me if you have a strong stomach.
You won't scare me off with that. McGovern seemed pleased.
McGovern was not the sort to follow anyone around, and after I had turned on the burner in the decomposition room, she lingered long enough for steam to rise. Then she headed out to ATF's Richmond field office and reappeared suddenly within an hour. She was breathless and tense when she walked in. I was carefully stirring simmering bones.
We got another one, she quickly said.
Another one? I asked. I set the long plastic spoon on a countertop.
Another fire. Another wacko one. This time in Lehigh County, about an hour from Philadelphia, she said. Are you coming with me?
My mind raced through all the possibilities of what might happen if I dropped everything and left with her. For one thing, I was unnerved by the thought of the two of us alone for 5 hours inside a car.
It's residential, she went on. It started early yesterday morning and a body has been recovered. A woman, in the master bathroom.
Oh, no, I said.
It's clear the fire was intended to conceal that she'd been murdered, she said, and then went on to explain why it was possible the case was related to the one in Warrenton.
When the body was discovered, Pennsylvania State Police had immediately requested assistance from ATF. Then ATF fire investigators at the scene had entered data on their laptops and ESA got a hit almost instantly. By last night, the Lehigh case had begun to take on huge significance, and the FBI offered agents and Benton, and the state police had accepted. The house was built on a slab, McGovern was explaining as we got on I-95 North. So no basement to worry about, thank God. Our guys have been there since 3 o'clock this morning, and what's curious is in this case the fire didn't do the job well at all. The areas of the master suite, a guest room right above it on the second floor, and the living room downstairs are pretty badly burned, with extensive ceiling damage in the bathroom and spalling off the concrete floor in the garage. Spalling occurs when rapid, intense heat causes moisture trapped in concrete to boil, fragmenting the surface. The garage was located where? I asked, as I tried to envision what she was describing. On the same side of the house as the master suite, Again, a fast, hot fire. But the burning wasn't complete. A lot of alligatoring, a lot of surface charring. As for the rest of the house, we're talking mostly smoke and water damage, which isn't consistent with the work of the individual who torched Sparks Farm. Except for one important thing. So far, it doesn't appear that any type of accelerant was used, and there wasn't a sufficient fuel load in the bathroom to account for the height of the flames.
Was the body in the tub?
I asked. Yes. Makes my hair stand on end.
It should. What kind of shape is she in?
I asked the most important question, as McGovern held our speed 10 miles over the limit in her government Ford Explorer. Not so burned that the medical examiner couldn't tell her throat was cut.
Then she's already been autopsied, I assumed.
To be honest, I really don't know how much has been done, but she's not going anywhere. That's your turf. Mine's to see what the hell else we can find at the fire scene.
So you're not going to use me to shovel out debris?
I asked. McGovern laughed and turned on the CD player. I was not expecting Amadeus. You can dig all you want, she said with a smile that relieved a lot of tension. You're not bad at it, by the way, for someone who probably doesn't run unless she's being chased, or work out anything except intellectual problems. You do enough autopsies and move enough bodies, and you don't need to lift weights. I distorted the truth, badly. Hold out your hands. I did, and she glanced over at them, changing lanes at the same time. Damn. I guess it didn't occur to me what saws and scalpels and hedge pruners will do for muscle tone, she commented.
Hedge pruners?
You know, what you use to open the chest.
Rib shears, please.
Well, I've seen hedge pruners in some morgues, and knitting needles used to track bullet wounds. Not in my morgue. At least not in the one I have now. Although I will admit that in the early days one learned to improvise, I felt compelled to say, as Mozart played. One of those little trade secrets you don't want to ever come out in court, McGovern confessed. Sort of like stashing the best jar of confiscated moonshine in a secret desk drawer. Or cops keeping souvenirs from scenes, like marijuana pipes and wacko weapons. Or medical examiners hanging on to artificial hips and parts of fractured skulls that in truth should be buried with the bodies. I won't deny that some of my colleagues aren't always appropriate, I said. But keeping body parts without permission is not in the same category as pinching a jar of moonshine, if you ask me. You're awfully straight and narrow, aren't you, Kay? McGovern stated. Unlike the rest of us, you never seem to use poor judgment or do anything wrong. You probably never overeat or get drunk. And to be honest, it makes the rest of us schleps afraid to be around you, afraid you'll look at us and disapprove.
Good Lord, what an awful image, I exclaimed. I hope that's not how I'm perceived.
She said nothing. Certainly I don't see myself that way, I said. Quite to the contrary, Tian.
Maybe I'm just more reserved because I have to be. Maybe I'm more self-contained because I always have been. And no, it's not my tendency to publicly confess my sins. But I don't look around and judge. And I can promise I'm much harder on myself than I'd ever be on you.
That's not been my impression. I think you size me up and down and inside out to make sure I'm suitable to train Lucy and won't be a pernicious influence.
I could not answer that charge because it was true. I don't even know where she is, I suddenly realized.
Well, I can tell you. She's in Philly, bouncing back and forth between the field office and her new apartment.
For a while, music was our only conversation. And as the Beltway carried us around Baltimore, I could not help but think of a medical student who also had died in a suspicious fire.
Tian, I said, how many children do you have?
One, a son.
I could tell this was not a happy subject.
How old is he?
I asked.
Joe is 26.
He lives nearby?
I stared out the window at reflective signs flowing by, announcing exits to Baltimore streets I used to know very well when I studied medicine at Johns Hopkins.
I don't know where he lives, to tell you the truth, she said. We were never close.
I'm not sure anyone has ever been close to Joe.
I'm not sure anyone would want to be.
I did not pry, but she wanted to talk. I knew something was wrong with him when he started sneaking into the liquor cabinet at the tender age of 10, drinking gin, vodka, and putting water in the bottles, thinking he would fool us. By 16, he was a raging alcoholic, in and out of treatment, DUIs, drunken disorderlies, stealing, one thing after another. He left home at 19, skipping around here and there, and eventually cut off all contact. To be honest, he's probably a street person somewhere. You've had a hard life, I said. 14. The Atlanta Braves were staying at the Sheraton Hotel on Society Hill when McGovern dropped me off at almost 7 p.m. Groupies, old and young, were dressed in baseball jackets and caps, prowling hallways and bars with huge photographs in hand to be signed by their heroes. Security had been called, and a desperate man stopped me as I was coming through the revolving door. "Have you seen them?" he asked me, his eyes wildly darting around. "Seen who?" I said. "The Braves!" "What do they look like?" I asked. I waited in line to check in, not interested in anything but a long soak in the tub. We had been held up 2 hours in traffic just south of Philadelphia, where five cars and a van had smashed into each other, sending broken glass and twisted metal across six lanes. It was too late to drive another hour to the Lehigh County morgue. That would have to wait until morning, and I took the elevator to the fourth floor and slid in my plastic card to open the electronic lock. I opened curtains and looked out at the Delaware River and masts of the Moshulu moored at Penn's Landing. Suddenly I was in Philadelphia with a turnout bag, my aluminum case, and my purse. My message light was blinking, and I listened to Benton's recorded voice saying that he was staying at my same hotel and should be arriving as soon as he could break free of New York and its traffic. I was to expect him around 9. Lucy had left me her new phone number and didn't know if she'd see me or not. Marino had an update that he would relay when I called, and Fielding said the Quinns had gone on the television news earlier this evening to say they were suing the medical examiner's office and me for violating the separation of church and state and causing irreparable emotional damage. I sat on the edge of the bed and took off my shoes. My pantyhose had a run, and I wadded them and hurled them into the trash. My clothes had bitten into me because I had worn them too long, and I imagined the stench of cooking human bones lingering in my hair. Shit, I exclaimed under my breath. What kind of goddamn life is this? I snatched off my suit, blouse, and slip and flung them inside out on the bed. I made sure the deadbolt was secure and began filling the tub with water as hot as I could stand it. The sound of it pouring on top of itself began to soothe me, and I dribbled in foaming bath gel that smelled like sun-ripened raspberries. I was confused about seeing Benton. How had it all come to this? Lovers, colleagues, friends, whatever we were supposed to be had blended into a mixture, like paintings in sand. Our relationship was a design of delicate colors, intricate and dry and easily disturbed. He called as I was drying off.
"I'm sorry it's so late," he said.
"How are you?" I asked.
"Are you up for the bar?"
"Not if the Braves are there. I don't need a riot."
"The Braves?" he asked.
"Why don't you come to my room? I have a minibar."
"In 2 minutes."
He showed up in his typical uniform of dark suit and white shirt. Both showed the harshness of his day, and he needed to shave. He gathered me in his arms, and we held each other without speaking for a very long time. "You smell like fruit," he said into my hair. "We're supposed to be in Hilton Head," I muttered. "How did we suddenly end up in Philadelphia?" "It's a bloody mess," he said. Benton gently pulled away from me and took off his jacket. He draped it over my bed and unlocked the minibar.
"The usual?" he asked.
"Just some Avion."
"Well, I need something stronger."
He unscrewed the top of a Johnny Walker.
"In fact, I'll make that a double, and the hell with ice," he let me know.
He handed me the Avion, and I watched him as he pulled out the desk chair and sat. I propped up pillows on the bed and made myself comfortable as we visited each other from a distance.
"What's wrong?" I asked.
"Besides everything."
"The usual problem when ATF and the Bureau are suddenly thrown together on a case," he said, sipping his drink. "It makes me glad I'm retired."
You don't seem very retired, I wryly said.
That's the damn truth. As if Carrie isn't enough for me to worry about.
Then I'm called in on this homicide, and to be honest, Kay, ATF has its own profilers, and I don't think the Bureau should be poking its nose into this at all.
Tell me something I don't know, Benton. And I don't see how they're justifying their involvement, for that matter, unless they're saying this lady's death is an act of terrorism.
The potential link to the Warrington homicide, he told me, as you know. And it wasn't hard for the unit chief to call state police investigators to let them know the Bureau would do anything to help. So then Bureau's invited in, and here I am. There were two agents at the fire scene earlier today, and already everybody's pissed off.
You know, Benton, supposedly we're all on the same side, I said, and this same old subject made me angry again.
Apparently this one FBI guy who's with the Philly field office hid a 9mm cartridge at the scene to see if Pepper would hit on it. Benton slowly swirled scotch in his glass. Of course Pepper didn't, because he hadn't even been told to go to work yet, he went on. And the agent thought this was funny, saying something about the dog's nose needing to go back to the shop.
What kind of fool would do something like that? I asked, incensed. He's lucky the handler didn't beat the hell out of him.
So here we are, he went on with a sigh. Same old shit. In the good old days, FBI agents had better sense than that. They weren't always flashing their shields in front of the camera and taking over investigations they aren't qualified to handle. I'm embarrassed. I'm more than embarrassed. I'm enraged that these new idiots out there are ruining my reputation along with their own after I worked 25 years. Well, I just don't know what I'm going to do, Kay.
He met my eyes as he drank. Just do your good job, Benton, I quietly said to him. Trite as that may sound, it's all any of us can do. We're not doing it for the Bureau, not for ATF or the Pennsylvania State Police. It's for the victims and potential victims. Always for them.
He drained his glass and set it on the desk. The lights of Penn's Landing were festive outside my window, and Camden, New Jersey glittered on the other side of the river. I don't think Carrie's in New York anymore, he then said as he stared out into the night.
A comforting thought.
And I have no evidence for that, beyond there being no sightings or any other indicators that she is in the city. Where is she getting money, for example? Often that's how the trail begins. Robbery, stolen credit cards. Nothing so far to make us think she's out there doing things like that. Of course, that doesn't mean she isn't, but she has a plan, and I feel quite confident that she's following it.
His profile was sharp in shadows as he continued staring out at the river.
Benton was depressed. He sounded worn out and defeated, and I got up and went to him.
We should go to bed, I said, massaging his shoulders. We're both tired, and everything seems worse when we're tired, right?
He smiled a little and closed his eyes as I worked on his temples and kissed the back of his neck. How much do you charge per hour? He muttered.
You can't afford me, I said.
We did not sleep together because the rooms were small and both of us needed rest. I liked my shower in the morning and he liked his, and that was the difference between being new with each other versus comfortable. There had been a time when we stayed up all night consuming each other because we worked together and he was married and we could not help our hunger. I missed feeling that alive. Often when we were with each other now, my heart was dull or felt sweet pain, and I saw myself getting old. The skies were gray and the streets were wet from washing when Benton and I drove through downtown on Walnut Street a little past 7 the following morning. Steam rose from grates and manholes, the morning damp and cool. The homeless slept on sidewalks or beneath filthy blankets in parks, and one man looked dead beneath a no-loitering sign across from the police department. I drove while Benton went through his briefcase. He took notes on a yellow legal pad and thought about matters beyond my ken. I turned on to Interstate 76 West, where taillights were strung like red glass beads as far ahead as I could see, and the sun behind us was bright.
Why would someone pick a bathroom as a point of origin? I asked. Why not some other area of the house?
Obviously it means something to him if we're talking about serial crimes, he said, flipping a page.
Symbolic, perhaps. Maybe convenient for some other reason. My guess is that if we're dealing with the same offender and the bathroom is the point of origin that all of the fires have in common, then it is symbolic. Represents something to him. Perhaps his own point of origin for his crimes. If something happened to him in a bathroom when he was a young child, for example. Sexual abuse, child abuse, witnessing something terribly traumatic. Too bad we can't search prison records for that. Problem is, you'd come up with half the prison population. Most of these people come from abuse. Than they do unto others. They do worse unto others, I said. They weren't murdered. They were, in a sense. When you were beaten and raped as a child, your life is murdered, even if your body isn't. Not that any of this really explains psychopathy. Nothing I know of does, unless you believe in evil and that people make choices. That's exactly what I believe. He looked over at me and said, I know. What about Carrie's childhood? How much do we know about why she's made the choices she has? I asked. She would never let us interview her, he reminded me. There isn't much in her psychiatric evaluations except whatever her manipulation of the moment was. Crazy today, not tomorrow. Disassociating, depressed and non-compliant, or a model patient. These squirrels have more civil rights than we do, Kay. And prisons and forensic psychiatric centers are often so protective of their wards that you would think we're the bad guys. The morning was getting lighter, and the sky was streaked violet and white in perfect horizontal bands. We drove through farmland and intermittent cliffs of pink granite corrugated with drill holes from the dynamite that had blasted in the roads. Mist rising from ponds reminded me of pots of simmering water, and when we passed tall smokestacks with steamy plumes, I thought of fire. In the distance, mountains were a shadow, and water towers dotted the horizon like bright balloons. It took an hour to reach Lehigh Valley Hospital, a sprawling concrete complex still under construction, with a helicopter hangar and Level 1 trauma center. I parked in a visitor's lot, and Dr. Abraham Gerdes met us inside the bright new lobby. Kay, he warmly said, shaking my hand. Who would have ever thought you'd be visiting me here someday? And you must be Benton. We have a very good cafeteria here if you'd like coffee or something to eat first. Benton and I politely declined. Gerdes was a young forensic pathologist with dark hair and startling blue eyes. He had rotated through my office 3 years earlier and was still new enough at his profession to rarely have his status as an expert witness stipulated in court. But he was humble and meticulous, and those attributes were far more valuable to me than experience, especially in this instance. Unless Gerdes had dramatically changed, it was unlikely he had touched the body after learning I was coming. Tell me where we are in this, I said as we walked down a wide, polished gray hallway. I had her weighed, measured, and was doing the external exam when the coroner called. As soon as he said ATF was involved and you were on the way, I stopped the presses. Lehigh County had an elected coroner who decided which cases would be autopsied and then determined the manner of death. Fortunately for Gerdes, the coroner was a former police officer who did not interfere with the forensic pathologists and usually deferred to the decisions they made. But this was not true in other states or other counties in Pennsylvania, where the autopsies were sometimes performed on embalming tables in funeral homes, and some coroners were consummate politicians who did not know an entrance from an exit wound or care. Our footsteps echoed in the stairwell, and at the bottom, Gerdes pushed through double doors and we found ourselves in a warehouse stacked with collapsed cardboard boxes and busy with people in hard hats. We passed through to a different part of the building and followed another hallway to the morgue. It was small, with a pink tile floor and two stationary stainless steel tables. Gerdes opened a cabinet and handed us sterile single-use surgical gowns, plastic aprons, and full-coverage disposable boots. We pulled these over our clothes and shoes, and then donned latex gloves and masks. The dead woman had been identified as Kelly Shepherd, a 32-year-old black female who had worked as a nurse at the very hospital where she was now being stored with the dead. She was inside a black pouch on top of a gurney inside a small walk-in refrigerator that held no other guests this day except bright orange packages of surgical specimens and stillborn infants awaiting incineration. We rolled the dead woman into the autopsy room and unzipped the pouch. "Have you x-rayed her?" I asked Gertie's. "Yes, and we've gotten her fingerprints. The dentist charted her teeth yesterday as well and matched them with pre-mortem records." Gertie's and I unzipped the pouch and opened it, and we unwrapped bloody sheets, exposing the mutilated body to the harsh glare of surgical lamps. She was rigid and cold, her blind eyes half open in a gory face. Gertie's had not washed her yet, and her skin was crusty with blackish red blood, her hair stiff with it like a Brillo pad. Her wounds were so numerous and violent that they radiated an aura of rage. I could feel the killer's fury and hate, and I began to envision her fierce struggle with him. The fingers and palms of both hands had been cut to the bone when she had tried to protect herself by grabbing the knife blade. She had deep cuts to the backs of her forearms and wrists, again from trying to shield herself, and slashes to her legs that most likely were from her being down on the floor and trying to kick the swings of the knife away. Stab wounds were clustered in a savage constellation over her breasts, abdomen, and shoulders, and also on her buttocks and back. Many of the wounds were large and irregular, and caused by the knife twisting as the victim moved or from the blade being withdrawn. The pattern of the individual wound configurations suggested a single-edged knife with a guard that had left squared-off abrasions. A somewhat superficial cut ran from her right jaw up to her cheek, and her throat had been laid open in a direction that began below the right ear and went downward, and then across the midline of the neck. "Consistent with her throat being cut from behind," I said as Benton silently looked on and took notes. "Head pulled back, throat exposed." "I'm assuming cutting her throat was his grand finale," Gertie said. "If she had received an injury like this in the beginning, she would have bled out too quickly to put up any kind of fight. So yes, it's very possible he cut her throat last, perhaps when she was face down on the floor. What about clothing?" "I'll get it," Gertie said. "You know, I get the strangest cases here. All these awful car crashes that turn out to be from some guy having a heart attack while he's driving. So he ends up airborne and takes out 3 or 4 other people. We had an internet murder not so long ago. And husbands don't just shoot their wives around here either. They strangle and bludgeon and decapitate them." He kept talking as he headed to a distant corner where clothing dried from hangers over a shallow basin. The garments were separated by sheets of plastic to ensure that trace evidence and body fluids from one weren't inadvertently transferred to another. I was covering the second autopsy table with a sterile sheet when T.N. McGovern was shown in by a morgue assistant. "Thought I'd check by before heading out to the scene," she said. She was dressed in BDUs and boots and carrying a manila envelope. McGovern did not bother with gown or gloves as she slowly surveyed the carnage. "Good Lord," she said. I helped Gertie's spread out a pair of pajamas on top of the table I had just covered. Tops and bottoms reeked of dirty smoke and were so sooty and saturated with blood that I could not tell their color. The cotton fabric was cut and punctured front and back. "She came in clothed in these?" I wanted to make sure. "Yes," Gertie's replied. "Everything buttoned and snapped. And I have to wonder if possibly some of the blood is his. In a fight like this, I wouldn't be surprised if he cut himself." I smiled at him. "Someone taught you well," I said. "Some lady in Richmond," he answered. At a glance, this would seem domestic. It was Benton who spoke. "She's home in her pajamas, perhaps late at night. A classic case of overkill, such as you often find in homicides where the two people had a relationship. But what's a little unusual," he stepped closer to the table, "is her face. Other than this one cut here," he pointed, "there doesn't appear to be any injury. Typically, when the assailant has a relationship with the victim, he directs much of his violence at the face because the face is the person." "The cut to her face is shallower than the others," I noted, gently spreading open the wound with my gloved fingers. "Deepest at her jaw and then tapering off as it travels up her cheek." I stepped back and looked at the pajamas again. "It's interesting that none of the buttons or snaps are missing," I said, "and no tears, such as you might expect after a struggle like this, when the assailant grabs the victim and tries to control her.
I think control is the important word here, Benton said.
Or lack of it, said McGovern.
Exactly, Benton agreed. This is a blitz attack. Something set this guy off and he went berserk. I seriously doubt he intended for this to go down anything like it did, which is also evidenced by the fire. It appears he lost control of that, too.
In my mind, the guy didn't hang around very long after he killed her, McGovern said. He torched the place on his way out, thinking it would cover up his dirty work. But you're absolutely right. He didn't do a good job. And added to that, when the lady's fire alarm went off at 1:58 a.m., trucks got there in less than 5 minutes, so the damage was minimal.
Kelly Shepherd had second-degree burns to her back and feet, and that was all.
What about a burglar alarm? I asked.
Wasn't armed, McGovern replied.
She opened the manila envelope and began spreading scene photographs over a desk. Benton, Gerdes, and I took our time studying them. The victim in her bloody pajamas was face down in the bathroom doorway, one arm under her body, the other straight out in front of her as if she had been reaching for something. Her legs were straight and close together, her feet almost reaching the toilet. Sooty water on the floor made it impossible to find bloody drag marks had they existed, but close-ups of the doorframe and surrounding wall showed obvious cuts to the wood that appeared fresh.
The fire's point of origin, McGovern said, is right here.
She pointed to a photograph of the interior of the scorched bathroom.
This corner near the tub where there's an open window with a curtain, she said. And in that area, as you can see, are burned remnants of wooden furniture and pillows from a couch.
She tapped the photograph.
So we've got an open door and an open window, or a flue and a chimney, so to speak. Just like a fireplace, she went on. The fire starts here on the tile floor and involves the curtains. But the flames didn't quite have the energy this time to fully engage the ceiling.
Why do you suppose that is? I asked.
Can only be one good reason, she replied. The damn thing wasn't built right. I mean, it's clear as day the killer piled furniture, couch cushions, and whatever into the bathroom to build his fire. But it just never got going the way it needed to. The initial fire was unable to involve the piled fuel load because of the open window and the flame bending toward it. He also didn't stand around and watch, either, or he would have realized he screwed up. This time his fire didn't do much more than lick over the body like a dragon's tongue.
Benton was so silent and still he looked like a statue as his eyes traveled over photographs. I could tell he had much on his mind, but typically he was guarded in his words. He had never worked with McGovern before, and he did not know Dr. Abraham Gerdes.
We're going to be a long time, I said to him.
I'm heading out to the scene, he replied.
His face was stony, the way it got when he felt evil like a cold draft. I gave him my eyes, and his met mine.
You can follow me, McGovern offered him.
Thanks.
One other thing, McGovern said. The back door was unlocked, and there was an empty cat pan in the grass by the steps.
So you think she went outside to empty the cat pan? Gerdes asked both of them. And this guy was waiting for her?
It's just a theory, said McGovern.
I don't know, Wesley said.
Then the killer knew she had a cat? I said dubiously. And that she eventually was going to let it out that night or clean out the cat pan?
We don't know that she didn't empty the litter box earlier that evening and leave it in the yard to air out, Wesley pointed out as he ripped off his gown. She may have turned off her alarm and opened the door late that night or in the early morning hours for some other reason.
And the cat? I asked. Has it shown up?
Not yet, McGovern said, and she and Benton left.
I'm going to start swabbing, I said to Gerdes.
He reached for a camera and started shooting as I adjusted a light. I studied the cut to her face and collected several fibers from it and a wavy brown hair, 4.5 inches long, that I suspected was her own. But there were other hairs, red and short, and I could tell they had been recently dyed because 1/16 of an inch at the root was dark. Of course, cat fur was everywhere, most likely transferred to bloody surfaces of the body when the victim was on the floor.
A Persian, maybe? Gerdes asked.
long, very fine fur? Sounds good to me, I said.
15. The task of collecting trace evidence was overwhelming and had to be done before anything else. People generally have no idea what a microscopic pig pen they carry with them until someone like me starts scouring clothing and bodies for barely visible debris. I found splinters of wood, likely from the floor and walls, and cat litter, dirt, bits and pieces of insects and plants, and the expected ash and trash from the fire. But the most telling discovery came from the tremendous injury to her neck. Through a lens, I found two shiny metallic specks. I collected them with the tip of my little finger and delicately transferred them to a square of clean white cotton cloth. There was a dissecting microscope on top of an old metal desk, and I set the magnification to 20 and adjusted the illuminator. I could scarcely believe it when I saw the tiny, flattened and twisted silvery shavings in the bright circle of light. "This is very important," I started talking fast. "I'm going to pack them in cotton inside an evidence container, and we need to make double sure there's no other debris like this in any of the other wounds. To the naked eye, it flashes like a piece of silver glitter. Transferred from the weapon?" Gertie's was excited, too, and he came over to take a look. They were embedded deep inside the wound to her neck. "So yes, I'd say that was a transfer, similar to what I found in the Warrington case," I answered him.
"And we know what about that?"
"A magnesium turning," I answered. "And we don't mention anything about this to anyone. We don't want this leaking to the press. I'll let Benton and McGovern know." "You got it," he said with feeling. There were 27 wounds, and after a painful scrutinizing of all of them, we found no other bits of the shiny metal, and this struck me as a little puzzling, since I had assumed the throat had been cut last. If that were the case, why wasn't the turning transferred to an earlier wound? I believed it would have been, especially in those instances where the knife had penetrated up to the guard and was swiped clean by muscular and elastic tissue as the blade is withdrawn. "Not impossible, but inconsistent," I said to Gertie's as I began measuring the cut to the throat. 4¾ inches long, I said, jotting it down on a body diagram. "Shallow up around the right ear, then deep, through the strap muscles and trachea, then shallow again on the opposite side of the neck. Consistent with the knife being drawn across the neck from behind by a left-handed assailant." It was almost 2 p.m. when we finally began washing the body, and for minutes water draining through the steel tabletop was bright red. I scrubbed stubborn blood with a big soft sponge, and her wound seemed even more gaping and mutilating when her taut brown skin was clean. Kelly Shepherd had been a beautiful woman, with high cheekbones and a flawless complexion as smooth as polished wood. She was 5'8", with a lean, athletic figure. Her fingernails were unpainted, and she had been wearing no jewelry when she was found. When we opened her up, her pierced chest cavity was filled with almost a liter of blood that had hemorrhaged from the great vessels leading to and from her heart and from her lungs. After receiving these injuries, she would have bled to death in, at the most, minutes, and I placed the timing of those attacks later in the struggle, when she was weakening and slowing down. The angles of those wounds were slight enough for me to suspect she had been moving very little on the floor when they had been inflicted from above. Then she had managed to roll over, perhaps in her last dying effort to protect herself, and I conjectured that this was when her throat was slashed. "Someone should have had an awful lot of blood on him," I commented, as I began measuring the cuts to the hands. "No kidding. He had to clean up somewhere. You don't walk into a motel lobby looking like that. Unless he lives around here. Or got into his vehicle and hoped he didn't get pulled for something. She's got a little brownish fluid in her stomach. So she hadn't eaten recently. Probably not since dinner, at any rate," I said. "I guess we need to find out if her bed was unmade." I was getting an image of a woman asleep when something happened either late Saturday night or in the early hours of Sunday morning. For some reason, she got up and turned off the alarm and unlocked the back door. Gertie's and I used surgical staples to close the Y incision at shortly past 4. I cleaned up in the morgue's small dressing room, where a mannequin used for staging violent deaths in court
was in a state of disarray and undress on the shower floor. Other than teenagers burning down old farmhouses, arsons in Lehigh were rare. Violence in the tidy middle-class subdivision called Wescosville, where Shepherd had lived, was unheard of as well. Crime there had never been more serious than smash-and-grabs, when a thief spied a pocketbook or wallet in plain view inside a house and broke in and grabbed. Since there was no police department in Lehigh, by the time state troopers responded to the clanging burglar alarm, the thief was long gone. I got my BDUs and steel-reinforced boots from my turnout bag and shared the same changing room with the mannequin. Gertie's was kind enough to give me a ride to the fire scene, and I was impressed by lush fir trees and roadside flower gardens, and every now and then a well-kept, unassuming church. We turned on Hanover Drive, where homes were modern brick and wood, two-story and spacious, with basketball hoops, bicycles, and other signs of children. "Do you have any idea of the price range?" I said, watching more houses flow past. "$200K to $300K range," he said. "Got a lot of engineers, nurses, stockbrokers, and executives back here. Plus, I-78 is the main artery through Lehigh Valley, and you can shoot straight out on that and be in New York in an hour and a half. So some people commute back and forth to the city." "What else is around here?" I asked. "A lot of industrial parks are just 10 or 15 minutes away. Coca-Cola, Air Products, Nestle Warehouses, Perrier, you pretty much name it, and farmland." "But she worked at the hospital." "Right, and that's at most a 10-minute drive, as you can tell." "Are you aware of ever having seen her before?" Gertie's thought for a minute as thin smoke drifted up from behind trees at the end of the street. "I'm fairly certain I've seen her in the cafeteria before," he answered. "It's hard not to notice someone who looked like that. She may have been at a table with other nurses, I don't really recall, but I don't think we ever spoke." Shepherd's house was yellow clabbered with white trim, and although the fire may not have been difficult to contain, the damage from water and from axes chopping great holes to vent the fire out of the roof was devastating. What was left was a sad, sooty face with a caved-in head, and shattered windows that were depressed, lifeless eyes. Borders of wildflowers were trampled, the neatly mown grass turned to mud, and a late-model Camry parked in the drive was covered with cinders. Fire department and ATF investigators were working inside, while two FBI agents in flak jackets were prowling the perimeter. I found McGovern in the backyard talking to an intense young woman dressed in cut-off jeans, sandals, and a T-shirt. "And that was, what, close to six?" McGovern was saying to her. "That's right. I was getting dinner ready and saw her pull into her driveway, parking exactly where her car is now," the woman excitedly recounted. "She went inside, then came out maybe 30 minutes later and began pulling weeds. She liked to work in the yard, cut her own grass and everything." McGovern watched me as I walked up. "This is Mrs. Harvey," she said to me, "the next-door neighbor." "Hello," I said to Mrs. Harvey, whose eyes were bright with excitement that bordered on fear. "Dr. Scarpetta is a medical examiner," McGovern explained. "Oh," said Mrs. Harvey. "Did you see Kelly again that night?" McGovern then asked. The woman shook her head. "She went in," she said, "I guess, and that was it. I know she worked real hard and usually didn't stay up late." "What about a relationship? Was there anybody she saw?" "Oh, she's been through them," Mrs. Harvey said. "A doctor here and there, different folks from the hospital. I remember last year she started seeing this man who had been her patient. Nothing lasted very long, it seems to me. She's so beautiful, that's the problem. The men wanted one thing, and she had something different in mind. I know because she used to make remarks about it." "But nobody recently?" McGovern asked. Mrs. Harvey had to think. "Just her girlfriends," she replied. "She has a couple people she works with, and sometimes they drop by or went off somewhere together. But I don't remember any activity that night. I mean, that's not saying I would know. Someone could have come over, and I wouldn't necessarily have heard a thing." "Have we found her cat?" I asked.
McGovern did not answer.
That darn cat, Mrs. Harvey said. Pumpkin. Spoiled, spoiled, spoiled.
She smiled, and her eyes filled with tears.
That was her child, Harvey said.
An indoor cat? I then asked.
Oh, absolutely. Kelly never let that cat out of the house. Treated him like a hothouse tomato.
His litter box was found in the backyard, McGovern told her.
Did Kelly sometimes empty it and leave it out all night? Or, for that matter, did she have a habit of emptying it at night, going out after dark, the door unlocked and the alarm off?
Harvey looked confused, and I suspected she had no idea that her neighbor had been murdered.
Well, she said, I do know that I've seen her empty the litter before, but always in a trash bag that went into the super can, so it wouldn't make sense for her to do that at night. My guess is she might have emptied it and left it outside to air, you know. Or maybe she just didn't have time to hose it off and was going to do it the next morning. But whatever the case, that cat knew how to use the toilet, so it wouldn't be any big deal for him to be without his litter box for a night.
She stared off at a state police car cruising by.
No one said how the fire started, Harvey went on. Do we know?
We're working on it, McGovern said.
She didn't die... Well, it was quick, wasn't it?
She squinted in the setting sun and she bit her lower lip.
I just don't want to think she suffered, she said.
Most people who die in fires don't suffer, I answered, evading her question with gentle words. Usually carbon monoxide overcomes them and they aren't conscious.
Oh, thank God, she said.
I'll be inside, McGovern said to me.
Mrs. Harvey, I said, did you know Kelly very well? We've been neighbors for almost 5 years. Not that we did a whole lot together, but I certainly knew her.
I'm wondering if you might have any recent photographs of her, or know someone who might?
I might have something.
I have to make sure of the identification, I then said, although my motive was other than that. I wanted to see for myself what Shepherd had looked like in life. And if there's anything else you can tell me about her, I would appreciate it, I went on. For example, does she have family here?
Oh, no, Harvey said, staring at her neighbor's ruined house. She was from all over. Her father was military, you know, and I think he and her mom live somewhere in North Carolina. Kelly was very worldly from having moved around so much. I used to tell her I wished I could be as strong and smart as her. She didn't take crap off anyone, let me tell you. One time there was a snake on my deck, and I called her all hysterical. She came on and chased it in the yard and killed it with a shovel. I guess she had to get that way because the men just wouldn't leave her alone. I always told her she could be a movie star, and she would say, "But Sandra, I can't act." And I would say, "But neither can most of them."
She was pretty streetwise then, I said.
You bet. That's why she had that burglar alarm put in. Feisty and streetwise, that's Kelly. If you want to come in with me, I'll see what I can do about pictures.
If you don't mind, I said. That's very nice of you. We cut through a hedge and I followed her up steps into her big, bright kitchen. It was apparent that Harvey liked to cook, based on a well-stocked pantry and every conceivable appliance. Cookware hung from hooks in the ceiling, and whatever was simmering on the stove smelled rich with beef and onions, perhaps a stroganoff or stew.
If you want to sit right over there by the window, I'll go get what I've got from the den, she said.
I took a seat at the breakfast table and looked out the window at Kelly Shepherd's house. I could see people passing behind broken windows, and someone had set up lights because the sun was low and smoldering. I wondered how often her neighbor had watched her come and go. Certainly, Harvey was curious about the life of a woman exotic enough to be a movie star, and I wondered if someone could have stalked Shepherd without her neighbor noticing a strange car or person in the area. But I had to be careful what I asked, because it was not publicly known that Shepherd had died a violent death.
"Well, I can't believe it," Harvey called out to me as she returned to the kitchen. "I got something better. You know, some television crew was at the hospital last week, filming a feature about the trauma center. It showed on the evening news, and Kelly was in it, so I taped it.
I can't believe it took me this long to think of it, but my brain's not working all that well, if you know what I mean.
She was holding a videotape. I accompanied her into the living room, where she inserted the tape into the VCR. I sat in a blue wing chair in a sea of blue carpet while she rewound and then hit the play button. The first few frames were of Lehigh Valley Hospital, from the perspective of a helicopter swooping in with an emergency case. It was then I realized that Kelly was really a med flight paramedic, and not merely a nurse on a ward. Footage showed Kelly in a jumpsuit dashing down a corridor with other members of the flight crew who had just been paged. "Excuse me! Excuse me!" she said on tape as they darted around people in the way. She was a spectacular example of the human genome working just right, her teeth dazzling and the camera in love with every angle of her fine features and bones. It was not hard to imagine patients getting major crushes on her. And then the film showed her in the cafeteria after another impossible mission had been accomplished. "It's always a race against time," Shepard was telling the reporter. "You know, even a minute's delay could cost a life. Talk about an adrenaline rush." As she continued her rather banal interview, the angle of the camera shifted. "I can't believe I taped that, but it's not often someone I know is on TV," Harvey was saying. It didn't penetrate at first. "Stop the tape," I said. "Rewind. Yes, right there. Freeze it." The frame was of someone in the background eating lunch. "No," I said under my breath. "No way." Carrie Grethen was wearing jeans and a tie-dye shirt and eating a sandwich at a table with other busy hospital personnel. I had not recognized her at first because her hair was below her ears and henna red, and last I had seen her it was short and bleached white. But it was her eyes that finally pulled at me like a black hole. She was staring straight into the camera as she chewed, her eyes as coldly bright and evil as I remembered. I came out of the chair and went straight to the VCR and popped out the tape. "I need to take this," I said, my voice on the verge of panic. "I promise you'll get it back."
"Okay, as long as you don't forget. It's my only copy."
Sandra Harvey got up too.
"Are you all right? You look like you've seen a ghost."
"I've got to go. Thank you again," I said. I ran next door and trotted up steps into the back of the house, where cold water was an inch deep on the floor and dripping slowly from the roof. Agents were moving about, taking photographs and talking amongst themselves.
"Tien,"
I called out. I carefully moved further inside, stepping over missing areas of flooring and doing my best not to trip. I was vaguely aware of an agent dropping the burned carcass of a cat into a plastic bag.
"Tien,"
I called out again. I heard sure feet splashing and stepping over fallen roofing and collapsed walls. Then she was mere inches from me and steadying my arm with her hand.
"Whoa, careful,"
she started to say.
"We've got to find Lucy," I said.
"What's going on?" She began to carefully escort me out.
"Where is she?"
I demanded. "There's a 2-alarm fire downtown, a grocery store, probably an arson."
"Kay, what the hell?"
We were out on the lawn and I was clutching the videotape as if it were my only hope in life.
"Tien, please,"
I held her gaze.
"Take me to Philadelphia."
"Come on," she said.
16.
McGovern made the trip back to Philadelphia in 45 minutes because she was speeding. She had radioed her field office and talked on a secure TAC channel. Although she was still very careful what she relayed, she had made it clear that she wanted every available agent out on the street looking for Carrie. While this was going on, I reached Marino on my cellular phone and told him to get on a plane now.
"She's here,"
I said.
"Oh, shit. Do Benton and Lucy know?"
"As soon as I find them,
I'm out the door," he said.
I did not believe, nor did McGovern, that Carrie was still in Lehigh County. She wanted to be where she could do the most damage, and I was convinced she somehow knew that Lucy had moved to Philadelphia. Carrie could have been stalking Lucy, for that matter. One thing I believed but could not make sense of was that the murders in Warrenton and now here were intended to lure those of us who had defeated Carrie in the past.
"But Warrenton happened before she escaped from Kirby,"
McGovern reminded me as she turned onto Chestnut Street.
I know,
I said, as fear turned my pulse to static. I don't understand any of it except that somehow she's involved. It's not coincidence that she was on that news clip, Tien. She knew that after Kelly Shepherd's murder we would review everything we could find. Carrie knew damn well we would see that tape.
The fire was located on a seedy strip on the western fringes of the University of Pennsylvania. Darkness had fallen, and flashing emergency lights were visible miles away. Police cars had closed off two blocks of the street. There were at least 8 fire engines and 4 ladder trucks, and more than 70 feet in the air, firefighters in buckets blasted the smoking roof with deluge guns.
This book is continued on Disc 8.